30 points. I'm Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into our Wednesday edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and as you know, each and every Wednesday on the broadcast, we do a special Worldview Wednesday edition of the program sponsored by World Magazine. We're going to do two different interviews today, one during the first half of the program until the bottom of the hour, and then we're going to switch gears just slightly and do another interview as well. Let me tell you what the two interviews are and who's going to be our guest on them, and then we'll launch right into an interview here with our first guest. First up today on the program is going to be Daniel Orlaski. Daniel works with World Magazine as a correspondent for World Magazine, and we're going to be speaking with Daniel about the 2010 Hope Awards. The award was for effective compassion. It was presented by World Magazine and the American Bible Society. They just announced the winner the other day, and so we want to get Daniel on to talk about the winner. The winner, by the way, was an organization called Freedom for Youth out of Des Moines, Iowa, and so we'll be talking with him in just a few moments about that award and about what this organization was doing that drew the attention there of World Magazine and the American Bible Society in order to give them this award. Secondly, on the broadcast at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by New York Times bestselling author Stephen Mansfield, and we'll be talking with him about his book, his most recent book, I should say, entitled The Faith and Values of Sarah Palin. He wrote a book about her, very interesting, and so we'll be talking about Sarah Palin and what he found out in writing this book. He had a lot of access to be able to do a lot of personal interviews and these types of things, and so we'll be talking with him about that at the bottom of the hour. Let's go to the phone line. We've got Daniel on the line. Daniel, welcome to the Knowing the Truth radio program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Daniel, tell us a little bit about this award, about how you guys go through this process, and just about the 2010 Hope Awards in general.
Okay, sure. Well, we started last winter in January, actually, and we solicited nominations from world readers for organizations that were working in their communities, ministries that were helping people in need and helping them, you know, both with their material needs, but also, crucially, with their spiritual needs. Mm-hmm. And so we got, you know, hundreds of nominations. We narrowed those down to three in each region. We sort of split it up into four regions. We had 12 regional semifinalists out of each region. We picked one winner. We wrote stories in all of them, and we picked one organization out of each region. And then we put it up to a vote on our website of those four, and we let the readers choose one who was our national winner.
And that winner came in this year, being the Freedom for Youth out of Des Moines, Iowa. Tell us, what is this organization about?
Well, Freedom for Youth is working in inner city Des Moines, and really what they're providing is an effective antidote to, the poison that inner city children are being fed you know, possibly in their home situations and, you know, in their schools. It's an after-school program. So what it does is it takes kids after school, and it works through all ages. They have a program for young kids, for elementary school. They have a program for teenagers. They also do some work with young adults. So it takes kids after school, and it teaches them, they do activities on the surface. So they'll learn skills like woodworking or metalworking or, art projects, music classes, computer classes. You know, that's all on the surface. But really what it does is it teaches these kids, you know, by helping them learn these skills, it teaches them that they're valuable. It teaches them, you know, it gives them self-esteem. It lets them know that they have something to offer to the world, and it teaches them about God.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of vocational schools, if you're familiar with that. We just talked a little bit about vocation on the broadcast for Labor Day. In fact, Marvin Olasky, I should tell our listeners there at World Magazine, did a number of stories about vocation, the Protestant understanding of that term, where we talk about it being a calling from God. What is our calling? And we did a number of broadcasts. Had Wayne Grudem on the broadcast to talk about his book, Gene Edward Veith, I think is how he pronounced it, Vice or Veith, on the program to talk about his book on that subject. But the idea of vocational school, again, being with the calling, I noticed when I looked at the video about Freedom for Youth, how many times they mentioned their God-given abilities in the young people that they were talking to. I bet you they mentioned it three or four times during the 10-minute video that I watched on this 2010 Hope Award winner. And so I was just interested in that. Is that built into it then? The way that they also look at their vocation, that this is what they're calling in his life, in their life. Is that what you saw there, Daniel, when you looked at this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really at the core of it. I think what it is that, you know, inner-city children are taught throughout their... And actually, it's not just... I shouldn't just say inner-city, because it's, you know, it's a lot of children in all sorts of bad environments.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the common denominator in those bad environments is that they're told that they're not worth anything, you know? They're told that they're not worth anything at home because maybe their parents are not on the scene. Maybe their parents are on the scene but engaging in destructive behaviors, and they're told that they're not worth anything at school because their schools are failing. Their schools just want to push them through and get them out of their hair. They don't want to really do any work on the person.
Mm-hmm.
So, kids who are growing up in that environment really start to believe this lie that, you know, they're worthless, that they don't have anything to offer to themselves, to their neighbors, anything to offer to God. And so I think what Freedom for Youth does really well is through these really simple things. It's not a big, fancy program. It's just, you know, volunteers, teaching skills, you know, being patient, offering love. It teaches kids that, you know, it doesn't matter what the rest of the world is telling you. We're telling you that you do have something to offer, even if it's as simple as you can build, this piece of furniture. You can learn computer skills. You have a beautiful voice, and you can sing.
Mm.
And we love you for that. And more importantly, God loves you for that. And I think, you know, it works both on a material level in that these kids are learning skills that, you know, will be useful. They learn engine maintenance, you know, and that's something that if they pursue will provide a career for them, you know. They learn welding and you know, skills that are needed that aren't being taught in schools anymore, necessarily. But more important than that, no matter what they decide to do with their lives, whether or not they they use those skills in the future or not. It's teaching them that they have something to offer. And if I can just give an example real quick, what they do is with these, every year in these classes, you know, they do these metalworking classes and they do these woodworking classes and they build, you know, furniture, they build decorative items. And then what they do is every year they have a big sale to raise money for the organization. And the kids not only, you know, build the items that they're selling, but they also, they run the store, they manage the cash registers, they, you know, that they're one, the manager of the store that they're selling stuff out is a kid in the program. So they're, you know, setting hours and they're being responsible for this whole thing. And, you know, when we talked to the director, really great guy named Mark Nelson, he said that the feeling that a kid gets when he sells something he made and realizes that what he did has value to somebody else, you know, and they're not just, you know, giving them charity or pity, that they actually, you know, made something that someone else wants that has value is, you know, enormously important in that kid's life.
Yeah, I totally agree. Let me remind our listening audience, we're speaking with Daniel Olasky. Daniel is a correspondent for World Magazine, and he's talking with us today about the 2010 Hope Award for Effective Compassion. It's an annual award presented by World Magazine and the American Bible Society. And Daniel, we didn't mention, but $5,000, if I understand this right, was given to the organizations, I think there were four of them that kind of made it to the final, semifinal round of the voting, and then the winner received an additional $5,000 plus the plaque or the actual award itself. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right, yeah.
So they could put that money right to work in what they're doing. And by the way, Daniel just mentioned, again, for our listeners, Daniel just mentioned that the Freedom for Youth director is Mark Nelson. Mark was a very successful businessman himself and just decided that he looked at his career path, where he was going. If I remember right, he was in an insurance company, and he just looked at where his career path was going and all of the things that he could achieve in that business. He was very successful already, and he just thought, you know, really that he wanted to get into helping people and helping youth rather than just making a lot of money. And so he resigned that position, and now he's the director of this organization that just won this award. And so it's a great story. They also have on their video that you can go out to worldmagazine.com and find it. But when you go out there, I think you could you can watch this for yourself, but you also see that there were other people that have made a significant amount of input in this organization as well. So they have given of themselves and retired from positions or just take part of their day, like Daniel was saying in the beginning, this runs after school, to come there to teach skills like welding. I saw in the video they were welding and woodworking skills. They had a fella that had retired from his position that was there helping them with woodworking. So this effective compassion idea is really working well in this particular setting. Daniel, I think you're completely right about, you know, having made something with your own hands is something that is very important. And you saw that firsthand, I guess, with the students that went through this program.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, when we were there for, you know, pretty much a full day, and it was during spring break when we were visiting, actually. So their schedule was a little bit different than it normally was. But I wrote about this in an article, but I actually sat in on a class that they were running for some girls. Mm-hmm. And it was this volunteer, a really sweet lady who just had some extra time. I think her husband volunteers there regularly, and she wanted to teach glass bead making. You know, it was her hobby, and she just wanted to share that. And glass bead making, you know, is not something that is going to make anybody rich, and it's not something that that has a lot of, you know, unlike some of the other stuff, that has a lot of intrinsic value. But it was great watching these girls learn about it, because it's something that's intricate. It's something that's, you know, that's doable, but it's a little bit complicated. It takes patience. It requires a certain knack to do, because you have to turn the glass at the right speed to keep it from cracking. And so these girls were doing it at first, and at first they were getting, you know, frustrated that they couldn't produce a perfect bead at first. But it was so great to see, you know, their teacher was just really, really patient and sweet, and she just kept saying, okay, you know, that happens, we can try it again. And by the end of the hour, they had produced this between the three of them, they had produced one bead that was, you know, a little bit wonky looking, but they were so proud of it. They were so happy with their bead, because they had really, all three of them worked together, and they had learned about it, and they were, at the end of that class, feeling really great about themselves. I think that just goes to show that it doesn't have to be some sort of really complicated program or system to affect people's lives, you know? Like, Mark is a great guy. He's put a ton of work into it, but I don't necessarily think that he had any specialized skills that other people don't have. He just had this calling, and he was willing to put the work in. And I think that that's if you're willing to be there and be present and give of your love, then you can make a difference no matter what exactly it is that you're offering. Yeah,
and that's really the story. As you started out, I guess, you mentioned that part of the goal here is to build relationships. And
absolutely.
So, you know, whether the bead is wonky, your term, or not when it comes out, still the way that they were interacting, I watched those girls make those the beads as well, and our listeners would be familiar with the, you know, they use like a small blowtorch type of thing, and they've got the glass in there and turning it very slow, and as you were describing that, it's a difficult process, but as they were doing that, they were interacting with each other, and they were interacting with the teacher that was there, and in such a way that it really helped to build a relationship where you could see that it would be, we talk about relationship evangelism, and you would think about it being an environment that would be conducive then, where the teacher could then speak about the things of God into the lives of these young people. And that really, I could see how that could happen very naturally in that environment.
And that's really what we talk about when we talk about effective compassion. You know, it's the Hope Award for effective compassion. And I think what that means is that it doesn't require a lot of money. It doesn't require a nice facility. It doesn't require a lot of equipment. It doesn't require, you know, a master's degree in social work to be effective. Mm-hmm. You know, what's required to be effective is getting in there and getting your hands dirty and being willing to take the setbacks and take the failures and just be present for a kid, to build a relationship, to let that child know God's love through you and through your presence. And that is going to be more effective than any amount of money or any amount of gadgetry or, you know, financial assistance in a child's life.
Mm-hmm. We should mention that the runners up, the ones that came in second through fourth on the contest that took place, Advance Memphis in Memphis, Tennessee, finished second, and they were followed by Rock Ministries in Philadelphia, and then also New Horizons in Cannon City, Colorado. Daniel, these are great stories. We really appreciate you. It's so good to hear good news about all of these 1,000 points of light that are out there of people just using their talents and abilities to reach out and to help other people with this effective compassion. Great stories here that you guys are participating in. I really appreciate the work you guys are doing there at World.
Well, thank you. And I'd really encourage people, if they're interested, to go to the website, worldmag.com, and take a look at the story about Freedom for Youth, but also about the stories for some of our other our semifinalists and even our regional winners, because I think all of those organizations, not just Freedom for Youth, are doing great work, and they all deserve all the attention that they get.
Good point. Let me tell our listeners, you can go out to the Web Extra section of World Mag. That's www.worldmag.com. You can go out to their Web Extra section, and there's an article there that could give you a good place to start. It says, "And the winner is," and then it has the 2010 Hope Award. They also have a search engine right there on the homepage, and you can simply just type in 2010 Hope Award, and it'll take you to the articles related to that. Daniel Olasky, thank you very much for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Okay. That was Daniel Olasky from World Magazine, correspondent with World Magazine. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and when we come back from the commercial, we'll be joined by Stephen Mansfield. Stephen is the author of the brand-new New York Times best-selling book, The Faith and Values of Sarah Palin, What She Believes and What It Means for America. And so if you got some questions about Sarah Palin and as to what she believes, as to how that's going to impact or has impact already or will impact our political scene or America in general, then this is the opportunity for you to call in. We'll be back in just a couple minutes.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
See you at the Poll. The annual student prayer event celebrates its 20th year on Wednesday. On the next Janet Mefford Show, I'll talk to spokesman Doug Clark to find out what's on tap. And economist Lawrence Kotlikoff says the government is not telling the truth about the national debt. He'll join me to talk about it. Plus, author Robert Ringer stops by to talk about his book, Restoring the American Dream. That's all next time on the Janet Mefford Show.
Weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 on Christian Talk 660 and 92.9 FM.
It's great pizza for a great price. So pack up the family and head over to Stevie B's near Walmart on Woodruff Road in Greenville. At Stevie B's, you'll find friendly faces and at least a dozen pizzas out at all times. Or you can order a pizza and they'll make it fresh just for you at no extra cost. So visit Stevie B's today.
Hi, this is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and I want to take the time to thank John, Ruth, Carlos, and the good folks over there at Stevie B's Pizza for their support of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
You, my friend, have connections in the government. Yes, you. USA.gov, the official source for government information on thousands of topics. And like any good connection, there's no telling where it can take you. Why, one day you're getting student loan information. Next thing you know, you need job hunting tips. Today's rogue construction info could have you searching for telecommuting ideas tomorrow. The more you use USA.gov, the more uses you'll find for it. Passport applications, for example. They've been known to lead to a sudden interest in travel advisories. Our new mobile apps will even update you on the go. So whether you have information to get or ideas to give your government, check out USA.gov. Who knows? Lottery results today could lead to retirement planning tomorrow. USA.gov. With the right connections, there's no telling where you can go.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome back into the second half of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. We spent the first half of the broadcast speaking with Daniel Olasky. I don't know why I'm having trouble. And Marvin Olasky's name, I don't have any trouble at all. But Daniel Olasky, and speaking with him about the 2010 Hope Awards from World Magazine. We're going to switch gears now and talk about a new book that has just come out called The Faith and Values of Sarah Palin, What She Believes and What It Means for America. The book is authored by New York Times bestselling author Stephen Mansfield, along with David Holland. And this book goes through, they had really extensive access to Palin's pastors, advisors, friends, and family. And it presents the truth about Sarah Palin, the faith that defines her, and the meaning of the faith for American politics and culture. So with us on the phone right now is New York Times bestselling author Stephen Mansfield. Stephen, welcome to the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Stephen, I understand, if I remember right, didn't you participate in the Amazing Grace DVD?
Yes.
Did you do
that? Yes, I did.
I think a second one is about to be launched here. You were involved in that one at all as well?
No, I wasn't available, but I was on the first one, and it was a real privilege.
Okay, yeah, I really enjoyed that myself, and actually a few people at church are starting to watch it a second time, and
that's great.
Enjoyed that. This seems like a fascinating book, and in the beginning of the book, you talk about when Sarah Palin comes on the scene. I think everybody in our listening audience is familiar with that. But you highlight just this unprecedented response that she receives, primarily in the book here to start with, from the left group of folks, you know, the pundits on the left, that just, you know, are just poisonous in their comments about her. Talk about that a little bit, if you would, please.
Yeah, I have seldom seen such vicious press regarding anybody on the left or the right, quite frankly. And so one of the things we wanted to do in this book was sort of explore why. And we came to the conclusion that it's because Sarah Palin, without even intending to, put her foot, so to speak, on some fault lines in American culture.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we all know that there is a liberal-conservative political divide in this country, but there's also an urban-rural divide in this country. A huge number of people, you know, obviously are more in what the elitists sometimes call flyover country, you know, small towns, middle America kind of thing, and she sort of represents that. Even though she's from Alaska, she's from a town that, when she was growing up, only about 2,000 people. Her whole state only has half the number of people in it of my hometown of Nashville, Tennessee. So she's definitely rural. Well, of course, the urban, more left-leaning folks, eastern seaboard folks, they don't like that. And so that divide has been sort of exploited, exposed, and there, that's part of the reason for the opposition against her. And then, of course, there's the her view of feminism, which is a major issue in the society, the conservative-liberal thing I've already mentioned, and then, of course, there's the secular religious divide in this country. You know, a lot of people, especially academic types, want to believe that religion is, you know, a phase in human history that's passing from the scene, and so they're surprised to find that many people believe in America as Sarah Palin does. So what we did in part of the book then was to explore some of these fault lines that she inherently puts her foot on and sort of exposes, and I think this explains why she's had such vehement opposition and at the same time such vociferous support.
Yeah, I thought that the introduction there where you laid that out is very insightful, and I don't know if people have really thought about it quite in the outline that you provide there. In all of those areas, she seems to be an oxymoron in some ways. Seems that she is, like you say, with the rural aspect, she's from this rural town. We like to say that. We like to talk about small town in America, but yet in reality, when a person like that comes out, we talk about him being too folksy, the you betcha part of what she talks. Immediately she's made fun of because of that. And one of the things that brought this out was the fact when she had written a couple comments on her hand, and you bring that out, and the type of reaction that received again from the left-leaning, primarily left-leaning pundits in our country. I mean, they were just brutal about her doing this.
Well, yeah, exactly. One of the things I think we brought out in the book that you've already seen at least part of is how some otherwise sane people in our popular media almost become absurd in their criticism of her. If you read the introduction, you know that, you know, Chris Matthews suddenly says, well, what do we think about a palm reader? I mean, it doesn't a kid in school who writes on his palm, isn't he cheating? Don't we? I mean, it's just silly. You know, a woman writes a couple of notes on her hand before a speech, for heaven's sakes, and it's and someone like Chris Matthews, who's a pretty good journalist, goes crazy. So, again, this is part of what we wanted to explore is why this opposition, and I think it says a lot about our culture. You know, why do the elites of the Eastern Seaboard and the media so despise rural hometown values. And then at the same time, on the air, they will actually exalt the fact, hey, we're a people of the soil, we're the American common man. You know, they'll sort of talk about the common man as though it's an abstraction. Mm-hmm. But let a common woman actually step on the national stage and, you know, speak with an accent that a lot of Kmart folks relate to. I mean, you know, you and mm-hmm. I have an accent, for heaven's sake. So
yeah.
Everybody's got one. And my point is that she has really become a lightning rod precisely because she stands right at these fault lines and causes strong reaction on both sides. But mm-hmm. it really, more importantly than just whether you like or dislike her, mm-hmm. it's revealing things about our culture, and therefore I think revealing things about our future.
And the same thing there with the religion, as you were talking about. We like to, for our presidents and for our leaders in this country, to be religious people. We like to see them going to church. We like to see that they believe in something bigger than themselves. And yet when she mentions that, although we say that we like it, again, we get that same visceral reaction from so many people. Other people, like you say, really love it and embrace her for it, but others, you know, just react so strongly against her.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there's a sense in which Sarah Palin is exposing some hypocrisy in American culture.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody would say, gee, I mean, the polls all show that people want their elected leaders to be people of faith and to be guided by moral values. But let someone be outspoken about it, and at least the media and some of the Eastern elites will attack them for having done it. So it's almost like, say a little bit about faith, but don't say too much or we'll attack you. Well, mm-hmm. you know, that's not legitimate. And so I'm saying there's a dynamic about Sarah Palin that's beyond just her as a person. Mm-hmm. It's about some cultural dynamics that she stepped right into the middle of, and I think she's still scratching her head over why both the positive and the negative is taking place. But it is, for those who are discerning, I think almost revealing, I'd use the word prophetic in the small P sense,
mm-hmm.
of maybe where our culture is going.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind our listening audience, we're speaking with New York Times bestselling author Stephen Mansfield about his book, The Faith and Values of Sarah Palin, What She Believes and What It Means for America. Stephen, in the book is broken into three segments, and in these three segments, one speaks, section one, the beginning, section two, the politics, and then section three, the national stage. I want to get you to summarize these for us if we could, but let me tell our listening audience, if you have a question or a comment, be happy to take your call. Got a toll-free number set up. It's good nationwide, 1-888-660-WLFJ. That's 1-888-660-9535. Also, email is up and running, kevin@knowingthetruth.org. Stephen, in this first section, talking about beginnings, give us a little snapshot of what you write about in that section.
Well, we talk about her roots in Alaska. You really can't understand Sarah Palin unless you understand Alaska, its unique context, its unique culture. I'm not trying to paint Sarah Palin like she's Daniel Boone or lived in Little House on the Prairie, but she did, given the fact that she wasn't born until 1964, you know, that's the same year the Beatles showed up in America,
mm-hmm.
She was living on the closest thing to an American frontier that still existed. She lived in a family where they chopped firewood to heat the home. They killed moose to eat, be able to have enough food. They didn't have a television until late in her life, and even then, the father, because he disliked television, put it in a room with no heat in it, so that the kids, you know, wouldn't stay in there very long. Books were the primary mode of entertainment, and singing. The family sang a lot. I mean, I know it sounds like Little House on the Prairie, but it really mm-hmm. is the culture she grew up in. So I tell people they have to understand Alaska, its history, its culture, and the kind of context that she had in order to understand her. And then of course, there's the whole value of sports. Sports played a huge role in her life, and we talk about that. And, of course, we talk about her faith.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother had a turning from the Roman Catholic faith of her childhood to sort of an evangelical conversion experience around the time that Sarah was maybe 9 or 10. And this, as it often does when adults convert, affected the whole family culture. And before long, Sally, who is the mother, began taking her children to Wasilla Assembly of God. So Sarah Palin grew up in a very biblically conservative, Pentecostal context, that had a profound impact on her life, and one youth pastor in particular, whom she credits as having a huge amount to do with her political career, spoke a great deal about destiny, about calling, and about how you very few people are called to serve in the pastorate and or in church leadership, but many are called to serve in the broader culture, including in the arena of politics.
Mm-hmm.
And when that youth pastor said that, that really quickened something in Sarah's soul. So the early years, it's just, you have to understand the childhood of anybody to understand who they are as an adult.
Sure.
But Sarah Palin comes from such an unusual founding context, so to speak, that we felt like it deserved some attention.
And those type of lessons that you point out from her upbringing there, where you mentioned that they had to chop wood and hunt and these types of things, there are lessons that are learned in those types of activities that you can't learn in any other way.
Exactly.
You certainly aren't going to pick it up at Harvard. And so, those types of down-home, folksy, for lack of a better term, but just down-to-earth lessons are something that we're seeing right now that the American people seem to want. They don't want these high platitudes and, professors giving us these things. They want people to speak plainly and clearly about the issues. And so this may be one of the reasons why she's so popular. Let's talk about the second section here under politics, which obviously is maybe an area that people are a little bit more, where Sarah Palin is a little bit more well-known to our listening audience. But give us a little snapshot of what you write in those chapters.
Well, in those chapters, we start with her early experience on the Wasilla City Council. As with many people who go on to political greatness, or at least fame, her political career began almost accidentally.
Mm-hmm.
She was asked to be on the city council, and she served there, and then she became mayor. Again, we're talking about a church, a city of only about a couple of thousand. And then she was appointed to a statewide board governing petroleum policy. All of this brought her into prominence, and at each level she had challenges, she had opposition. We talk about how she made decisions, how she evolved her kind of homespun politics, and then in time, of course, she ran for governor. And the progression there, I think, is very important. She's not from one of the elite Eastern schools. She's not from money. No one in her background ever served in any political role. There's an uncle who's a judge in the lower 48, but this was completely unique for her. And yet, I think it was her biblical values, this sense of destiny that she had, and the challenges of the moment politically, that really put her, caused her to pursue these positions. And it's a very interesting story, particularly some of the character tests that she had. And in a number of situations, she was put in positions of having to compromise or having to look the other way when people were doing things that were unethical politically. And, she made the right decisions while others who were working with her went to jail in some cases.
Mm.
So it's an interesting story. And I would just say again, it's the kind of thing that our media culture tends to exalt in the abstract, but when Sarah Palin steps on the stage and she is this story, it's interesting that the many of the folks in media don't value it, mm-hmm. don't celebrate it like they might. But it really is the kind of story that in another culture, mothers would have told their daughters to inspire greatness. It really is that kind of inspiring tale.
You entitle one of the chapters in that section, Five Smooth Stones, which is obviously a reference to David and Goliath, that she was outnumbered. And you write this, or you put this quote at the top of that chapter by Robert Jarvik. It says, leaders are visionaries with poorly developed sense of fear and no concept of the odds against them. And so she went in there with all of these odds against her, but seemed to be almost blissfully oblivious of them, and took these folks on and won in
she
many
did.
Cases.
She did. And I'll tell you that one of the things that is so pronounced about her and such a key to understanding her is that her faith produces many things in her life, but one of them is a very strong sense of destiny.
Mm-hmm.
She sometimes compares herself, we all have biblical characters that we feel more kinship to,
sure.
and she feels kinship to Esther, that she's constantly been put in positions where she was a bit over her head, where the challenges were great, but she took the attitude, I'm called to the kingdom for such a time as this, and if I die, I die.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that she really does have that kind of courage and that kind of sense of divine calling. And I think that's what causes her to stay on the national scene when she just gets blistered every single day in the media. And again, I'm saying to people, like her or not, vote for her or not, the bottom line is it's an inspiring tale regardless.
You write in the section here, an afterword of Section 2, the six pillars of Sarah Palin's politics. Let me mention a couple of these and have you just briefly articulate them for us. But the number one pillar, you write, is those unwilling to surrender power are not worthy to have power. Explain what you mean.
Well, at a number of junctures in Sarah Palin's life, she found herself having to lay down political power that had been given to her, largely because of ethical issues. Mm-hmm. And yet in each case, she ended up gaining great respect because of that decision or that position, and then following rising to greater prominence. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's that kind of biblical character lesson that we often teach and preach in our churches. I was a pastor for 20 years, and so I've certainly taught these lessons many times, mm-hmm. That if you're willing to surrender, if you're willing to humble yourself, if you're willing to sacrifice, then God will exalt you to new levels. And that really is one of the key themes in her life in politics, as the book expresses it.
The second pillar is the measure of good government is the good of the people. Please explain that one as well.
Time and again in Sarah Palin's life, she has been found herself suddenly on boards, committees, in politics with people who were feathering their own nest, who saw politics as a path to personal advancement. They took money they shouldn't have taken. They built businesses to get government contracts that they, you know, when their political decisions affected the well-being of that company, on and on and on. And Sarah has come to the conclusion, and I think governed accordingly, certainly in her years in Alaska, that the measure of good government is the good it does for the people, not for those who govern. Mm-hmm. And that time and time and time again has been her guide, and it also is what, by the way, propelled her into the conflict with the oil companies, which are so prominent in Alaska. Mm-hmm. You know, what she did in Alaska regarding oil petroleum policy was absolutely historic and transforming, mm-hmm. and she did it because she believed that the people were ill-served. And again, if you go back at any one moment in any of these character challenges in her political career, you could easily see that what she was deciding to do might be the end of her career, and yet every single time it led to greater heights. And I think that's an inspiring tale.
Let me just take one more from this section. Number four, private industry is of value, but private industry tethered to government is fascism.
Yeah, the very definition of fascism is government and business basically in bed with each other. Mm-hmm. This is what we fought with Mussolini, you know, several wars ago. This is what Nazism was to some extent. We see it elsewhere in the world. And this is what Sarah battled in Alaska, was government sort of in bed with the oil companies. Mm-hmm. And you know, the whole connection between the private and the public sector that we're dealing with right now in the Obama administration with the bailouts, and certainly with lobbyists and their connections to the public and the private sphere. So what she has addressed is very, very contemporary. And I think that, you know, it's a great American principle that we've actually sort of discarded, and that is the idea that there ought to be a major difference between the public and the private sector. Mm-hmm. And the two ought to be protected from each other and kept from each other in the service of the people. And that certainly is a pillar of Sarah Palin's politics.
The third section of the book deals with the national stage. She was thrust onto the national stage as she was selected to be the running mate with Senator McCain. I met Senator McCain. He came here to Greenville and met him over at a book signing promotion here at Barnes & Noble. But give us your take on the relationship then between her and Senator McCain.
Well, they like each other very much. She's been very loyal to him, and even helped him in his race in Arizona when he does not hold to some of the values that she does. Mm-hmm. There are a number of areas where they disagree, but she's so grateful to him and likes him so much that she helped him. I do think, though, that the culture of the McCain campaign absolutely shocked her, and caused her to be off balance and off her game. I think there was poor staff work, and that's why we see some of those real mess-ups, embarrassing interviews with Katie Couric and others later with Glenn Beck. And I think that, you know, John McCain's a military man. He's a Christian, but he's a military man, and so, you know, kind of a hard-hitting, cussing, raging kind of culture on the buses and in the campaign meetings certainly would have been the norm. She comes from a Pentecostal background. She's a mother. She's got her children with her, and I think that the cultural differences were huge, and she says as much in Going Rogue, and they I think she had a hard time as a result. That may be why we see her off balance to some extent. But the two have, their friendship has survived. They like each other, and I think that Sarah Palin is a woman of loyalty and gratitude, and she will forever be thankful to John McCain.
Let's talk about Going Rogue. Of course, the title of her book as well, but also the story of retiring there or resigning as the governor of Alaska, and then starting this whole process and what's taken place since then.
Well, I think that in Going Rogue, you know, she really does tell the story of the campaign from her perspective. But one of the things that we identified was that she had really soft-pedaled some of the issues of her faith, and particularly her conversion story. You know, she's an evangelical. She's a Pentecostal. She believes that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and that in order to be born again, you have to believe that, and that he died for the sins of the world and confess your sins, etc. And so there would have been a conversion moment, a conversion story to tell. In the book, though, I think, given that it was written on the other side of the campaign where she was so hammered for her faith and so embarrassed by YouTube videos released, you know, by her former church, that I think she soft-pedaled it. And the conversion experience written up in the book, if it can even be called that, is sort of, you know, I was looking out over the mountains and the wind, and I just knew that the same hand that controlled nature, you know, must surely control my life. And, you know, but it wasn't about Jesus. It wasn't about the things that we know it had to be about for her to be evangelical and Pentecostal. So we bring up the whole question of why does she feel the need to do that? Can a Pentecostal run for office in our modern culture without being humiliated for their faith? Has Sarah Palin sort of backed off on those issues, and will she continue to in future political races? So that's a lot of what we explore, and then we end the book with a chapter that I really like. It's called Seven Things Sarah Palin Needs to Know.
Right. I was going to go there next, in fact.
Yes.
And let's go through a couple of those.
Sure.
You write number one here, that love ennobles politics.
Yes, I believe that Sarah Palin, I like her. Our book is somewhat critical, but largely admiring. And I believe that she's better than the current tone of American politics. And I wish she would draw from her heritage, draw from her background, draw from what she knows to be true, and bring that to the fore. And I think she's at her best when she is speaking out of love. Love for Alaska, love for God, love for family, love for values. But she's been positioned by the McCain campaign and maybe even by her own audience, you know, as the attack dog of the right. And I don't think that's the best positioning for her. And I think if she stays in that mode, she will, she may pass from the scene much earlier than God intends, if she finds a broader basis for her politics. And that's why we're urging that.
Yeah, I agree with the, she appears when she comes in that mode to be in constraints, and you really don't see her. That's what I thought happened as soon as the McCain campaign took over. She appeared to be in a straitjacket and couldn't let out who she really was, which was what endeared so many people to her in the very beginning, just a plain-spoken soccer mom type of thing, but wanted to see her country succeed and didn't want to see it slip into socialism and other things that have subsequently happened. You put here, too, that they should hang a lantern, or she should hang a lantern on your weaknesses.
Yeah, I do a lot of political consulting, and one of the things I urge is that politicians hang a lantern on their weaknesses. What I mean by that is don't try to hide what's not good about you. Don't try to hide the negatives. Don't try to hide your weaknesses and your flaws. Talk about them openly.
Mm-hmm.
Hang a lantern on them. Be the first to expose them, and then you take away the target of your enemies, mm-hmm. of your political enemies. We might take a page, for example, out of Bill Clinton's book. I mean, very few people have messed up in public life like Bill Clinton, but he's become transparent about it. He's apologized for it. He's moved on, and now he's one of the most popular people in the world,
mm-hmm.
in terms of the polls.
Yeah.
And so what I'm saying is that she ought, I mean, if she's not as smart as she thinks she ought to be, if she's not as experienced, you know, we all know she overreached in that interview where she said, Russia's right next door to Alaska. I mean, just say, look, John McCain's the public policy expert, the foreign policy expert. I specialize in domestic affairs. Go with her strength, admit her mm-hmm. weaknesses. She would have removed that whole issue from the press. But instead, you know, I can see Russia from my house, which, of course, she never said, but it's more the Saturday Night Live line,
right.
is hung around her neck for the rest of her life. And I think that this is a principle of leadership. Just admit your faults and move on, and you remove the venom from your enemies.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree, and I think that she could have just, again, that nobody was expecting her to be a foreign policy expert or any of those things. And none of these people are. They all have people around them that advise them, and it would have been refreshing for her to say, you know what, I don't have all the answers on those things, but the basic character is what I'm bringing to the position, and the ability to make decisions once they're presented to me. I think the American people would have been just fine with that, and unfortunately they didn't do it. We're seeing that same, that would be great advice for Sherrin Engel as well as Christine O'Donnell. For Christine O'Donnell, I think, just said the other day, you know, now she's not going to meet with the media. You know, you can't make those types of statements. If you say something that's a little bit odd, you know, just explain it and move on. But I don't think you can now go into hiding. And so I think that hurts them. So.
Yeah, I think you're completely correct. I will say, last night I was in the Fox green room with Christine O'Donnell right before she went on the Hannity show. I actually recorded a segment right after her.
Oh, great!
And you will have to admit. I mean, we both have to admit that today her reputation has escalated a little bit because she explained what happened with the debt and
right.
you know whatever those issues were that the press was making a big deal out of. And I think this is a principle of politics. Don't try to hide things.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to cover it up. Just tell the truth and do it with a smile,
yep.
and say, this is the deal. You know, I always wished, as a guy who had to overcome some learning disabilities myself in my life, I always wished that George W. Bush, who I think is an undiagnosed dyslexic, would have gone and gotten diagnosed. Now, wouldn't that have changed things? If, as president, he found out he had a minor form of dyslexia, that would explain all the weird word convolutions in his speeches.
Yeah.
And wouldn't his stock have risen if he had talked about it publicly and maybe rallied American school children with learning disabilities? Man, we would have turned that whole thing around.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he's labeled as the most inarticulate president we've ever had. So,
mm-hmm.
I think this is a really vital tool, and it's just pride that leads mm-hmm. us in the other direction. It's just pride that makes us want to cover for ourselves. And I think she could lead the way in doing the opposite.
Yeah, I don't think anybody can have everything that people expect of them to be in that position. It would be far better to just say, you know, look at, I don't have, you know, a thousand different expertise in a thousand different areas, but what I bring to it is decision-making ability, and my background enables me to do that. I really think the American people understand that that's what happens anyways. I think these people get around them, and either they start believing their own press or they start listening to all these handlers, and they turn them into something that they're really not, and that's these are these creations that we see come out of this. But interesting book, Stephen. Really appreciate your time here, taking the time out to speak about this, and hope that people get really into reading this and get a good idea who Sarah Palin really is.
Well, it's great to visit with you. Thanks for the interview, and God bless.
Okay, thank you very much. That was Stephen Mansfield. Stephen is a New York Times best-selling author, and the name of the book is called The Faith and Values of Sarah Palin, What She Believes and What It Means for America. We're just able really to scratch the surface on all that he writes about here in the book, but if you're interested in more than just sound bites, if you're interested in more than just having, you know, a quick little take or some pundit's view of who Sarah Palin is, if you really want to hear from the people that know her the best, her pastors, her friends, family members, these types of folks, that's what Stephen Mansfield has done. He's gone behind the scenes. He's talked to them about who she is and what she said and where she came from and all of these different things. And then he's put it all here together in a book. And as he mentioned, it's not a glossed over image of who Sarah Palin is. It just tells the truth. And that's what we're trying to do on this program. We're just simply trying to get to the truth of the matter. We'll be talking about some issues tomorrow on the broadcast, I think. It's not confirmed yet, but we're looking at talking about the issue of global warming and a couple of things that have taken place in that arena. So that's what we'll be talking a little bit about tomorrow on the broadcast. You won't want to miss it. Let me mention out at our website, www.knowingthetruth, you can get a download of all the MP3 audio files. And remember what the Lord Jesus Christ said. He said that you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.
Life-changing teaching and talk for the Carolinas and Georgia. Christian Talk 660. WLFJ Greenville, Spartanburg, Anderson.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lisa Brady. The heads of two Iowa egg farms blamed for a salmonella outbreak.